Hey, 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 your host Ryan B. Raps back on the mic. Welcome back to another worthwhile period of procrastination rated 5 stars by Fitzy Boy, saying, while I was listening to this podcast, I accidentally caused a 401 car pileup on the 401. Well, ain't that a coincidence. Anyway, today I've actually got something we usually don't see here in the studio. A book. I don't think I've used one of these things in years, but this one was special. You see, I've come across a lot of terrible media in the past decade.
Go to the new Star Wars movie.
But this, without a doubt, is the most interesting story I've read in a while. I picked this gem up in the far-off lands of the suburbs. All jokes aside, after I found this book and saw that cute Jetsons Future of the Past, I could already tell this thing was old, but my god, I didn't expect it to be almost 100 years old. Turns out it was officially released in 1932 by a man named Aldous Huxley. Speaking of Mr. Huxley, he was born in 1894, just a few decades before the war broke out. Apparently he was born into an intellectual big-brain family in the historic town of Godalming. Why is it historic? Yeah, I don't know either, to be honest. A fun fact about this famous writer, he was almost blinded. At a young age, this dude was hit by a nasty disease, punctate to be specific, but that didn't stop him. He managed to live with his eyes intact, although he did end up partially blind, making it really hard to read. Kind of ironic he was an author in the end, huh. Moving on. After this prodigy got out of Oxford with an honors, the madman proceeded to release a string of critically acclaimed novels, which finally leads us back to Brave New World, his so-called best work. Speaking of the time period, people to this day claim that it predicted the future. It was released in 1932, right before the war, so as you may imagine, a book about a totalitarian government ruling the world with conditioning wasn't too dissimilar to Hitler's regime. But for today, I don't really know what they mean. I'm just going to take a far-out guess and think they're talking about that big country in the north. You know the one I mean. Speaking of the time periods, at the time it was released, people pretty much feared the new world this book portrayed. The fear of the idea that the future could possibly look like this got it banned in lots of countries. Thank goodness it's back, but some school libraries still haven't lifted that ban. It's a shame, really, knowing some people may never get to see this book. So, let's get on to the setting. If I were to describe Brave New World's setting in one sentence, it'd be, welcome to a world of infinite pleasure and stability, with not a moment of negativity to be found. Now, as cool as the world sounds, the reality of the situation is, it's a bit whack. The reason I know this? All you have to do is read the first chapter where it introduces the Central London Hatchery and Conditioning Center, which is pretty much what reveals the price the world pays for being the way it is. The place is supposedly the origin of all life in the world state cities. If you're wondering what the world state is, it's basically a government where 10 people rule the world. And this story just happens to take place in London. Now, I know the name Hatchery and Conditioning Center sounds bad, but trust me, it's much worse inside. Inside this pretty much chicken coop, decanters, as they call them, are taking fertilized eggs and dividing them up into 94 sets of identical twins with predetermined genetic qualities. If you're wondering what that means, they're pretty much saying they're deciding the fate of the people before they even have the conscience to choose. But wait, there's more. The people are divided into classes. Alphas, betas, gammas, deltas, and epsilons. Each class is made for a specific job, kind of like worker bees if you think about it. When the kids are growing up, they go through a thing called classical conditioning. To make it simple, think of how your dog gets excited when you walk over to the place you hide their treats. Your dog's associated you with walking over to the treats, and once they see the treats, they get really excited. Once you've gone over to your not-so-secret hidey hole so many times, they know what you're going to do before you even get the treats, and just get excited. So what I'm pretty much saying is you're associating a place or an object with an emotional response. And that's pretty much classical conditioning for dummies. Unfortunately, what the dog goes through pales in comparison to what the human kids go through. As kids, nurses in the factory gather the single-digit age children into a room and lay books and examples of nature, kind of like flowers and other things, in front of them. Then, while the kids are distracted, They shock them as they're interacting with whatever's on the floor. This makes the kids fear the books and the nature, actually making them more effective workers as they'll never desire anything outside of what the city has to offer. So with that knowledge, you'd think this world is a garbage fire. But to most of the residents, it's the complete opposite. You see, the thing the world state strives for in this book is stability. And in the state's eyes, stability is consumerism. So they shock the kids at a young age, so they dislike old lasting objects like literature or nature, which pretty much obliterates the concept of being passionate for something, or just caring for anything in general. Then when they grow up, without knowing passion or liking anything outside of what the city offers, they just indulge in a bunch of temporary joys, keeping the money flowing. Oh, and I almost forgot. The state hands out drugs called Soma that just removes all unpleasant feelings, emotions, importantly, and gives the user a high, which pretty much just gets rid of all instability the world state might have had to deal with. Sounds peachy, doesn't it? Now, I've been talking for about 3 minutes just about the setting, but now that we're done with it, I'm pretty sure you're wondering, Mr. B Raps, where is the plot? But plot twist, the plot is actually just all of the character arcs. What's so cool is each character arc in this book literally takes up so much space in the story that the characters just become the story. And the trials and tribulations these guys go through are uniquely designed to cause problems for that specific character so he can relate to it. And drive the story forward in the process too. If you're wondering what I mean, to put it short, X obstacle causes problems for X character, and overcoming or just failing to overcome that problem drives the story forward. Hopefully you caught my drift there, but getting back on track, these little obstacles our characters face shape the story. And since I've been talking so much about the characters, I might as well introduce a couple. First off, we got an independent, free-thinking rebel as our main protagonist and character, Bernard Marx, until he's pretty much replaced by another misunderstood, free-thinking, oddball main character, John the Savage. Now, I know it seems really confusing, but the best way to describe what's happening here is the first half of the book mainly focuses around Bernard, and the second half mainly focuses around John, but they both progress the story, and they're both affected by the story in one way or another. Anyway, a couple side characters include a regular citizen of the world state named Lenina, who the author describes as, and I quote, full of air. Take that any way you feel, but I think we all know what he means. The next character is Helmholtz Watson, a rebel of sorts that loves Shakespeare's work after John introduces it to him, but laughs at the idea of natural birth, showing that the world state can drill information into your head without you even being aware of it. Alright, so as much as I want to talk about what actually happens in this story, it would probably take me about 3 hours, so I'm just going to tell you what I'm thinking at this point. Now, our main antagonist, Mustafa Mond, the leader of London himself, has some strange ideologies, but over time I kind of realized how they applied to the city. The regular citizens were, they were happy, yes, but practically brain dead because of all of the drug-induced psychosis, I guess you could call it that, and all of the instant gratification. Well, the free-thinking rebels were almost always miserable because they knew what the world state was doing to the world and just hated it. But they had the freedom of thought. So the question the author is telling us to figure out is, would you rather be happy or free? And now, for the grand finale, we finally make it to the ending. I'm going to speed this one up a little because it's almost as long as the plot. I just want you to close your eyes for a second and imagine what the ending might be. Now, if you're done, I almost guarantee whatever you thought about wasn't nearly as strange as what happened at the end of this book. So at the very end, John is trying to live a peaceful life in the countryside after figuring out he can't live with Helmholtz and Bernard. He lives alone in a lighthouse and is constantly being mocked by anyone that passes by. But little does he care about what the people say at the time because he's on the brink of breaking after struggling with thoughts of Lenina over and over and over again. If he thinks about her for even a second, he feels deep guilt for even doing so. Convinced that the lust is getting to him, a deep anger arises within him, causing him to whip himself out of penance. The whipping was taught to him in the Indian Reserve, and it was religion. He still follows it to this day. He does this so many times, his back starts bleeding. He's struggling to figure out what the true meaning of being human even is anymore. Is it the shallow life of citizens in the city, or as the life he's known since a child. John was struggling with his thoughts and didn't realize he was out in broad daylight with the whip. Without even realizing it, a crowd forms around him, yelling and taunting him, and then he sees it. They're treating his penance like it's a crazy stunt. His anger rises, causing him to whip even more, as at this point, anger is just associated with the pain. As said by a person much smarter than myself, he realized the truth he sought so hard to find was nowhere to be seen. And in that moment, the thing he had strived to become human, the crowd no longer saw. In that moment, the crowd saw what was less than human. Now, after that, I was feeling pretty down, but then the book just hits you with this. After whipping himself for who knows how long, Lenina comes through the crowd and walks up to him, giving him kind of a puppy dog eyes, I guess you could call it that. It's a sob stare. And after a few seconds of looking at each other, he whips Lenina, sending the crowd into a riot that turns into a violent orgy, where everyone is singing their favorite song, Orgy Porgy. And the next morning, John is found dead in his lighthouse. I literally had no words at the time to describe what just happened after that, but thank God I figured it out. From what I've gathered, John's anger was associated with pain, so the whipping is pain. And when he sees Lenina, lust and anger combine, and he forms some twisted image in his head where he inflicts pain on someone else instead of him, and he whips her instead. Obviously, the citizens of Lenden in this world are just mentally messed, so of course they orgy, but the next morning, John was so ashamed by what he did, he hung himself out of guilt. And that's it. That's how it ends. Reading this book was an experience like no other. It starts off a bit slow, yeah, but it easily gets you captivated in the world of the characters. Now, to be honest, I really thought I'd be going on about this for like 20 minutes, but thank God I shortened it down. So, it's interesting in so many ways, and I don't think there's much out there like it. If I were going to give it a rating, it would probably be a 10 out of 10. This is Ryan B. Raps with another episode of Worthwhile Procrastination. Catch you later.